Welcome to the Writer Magazine Insider Podcast. I'm Greg Drevenstedt, editor-in-chief of Writer Magazine. I've got my good friend and colleague Kevin Duke with me. Today's episode is sponsored by Fly Racing. Since 1998, Fly Racing has aimed to provide customers with the very best in off-road performance products. Led by the revolutionary Formula S smart helmet, Fly Racing continues to push innovation and safety to new levels. Never before has style and technology blended together so seamlessly as the 2024 Fly Racing lineup. For more info, check out flyracing.com or your local Western Powersports dealer. Also, follow at Fly Racing USA on social media and cheer for all of the Fly Racing riders in the Super Motocross World Championship. So thanks, Fly Racing, for the support. So yeah, back on the show, I mean, you and I did a show about 2024 motorcycles last month. And, you know, there's more than 70 new bikes that are new or updated. And we're really talking about street legal bikes. You know, we don't really deal with the dirt bikes on the show much, but that covers everything from dual sports and adventure bikes, sport bikes, cruisers, and all that. So yeah, we've more than 70 new models. But the interesting thing is, I've got a list here from our new and updated bikes, and I've got nearly 30 new and updated models or adventure bikes. I mean, that's crazy. That's one segment, and it's nearly half of what are the new and updated motorcycles for the 2024 model. So that's what we're going to talk about this episode is adventure bikes.
It's fun to see how it's developed over the years. Adventure bikes were very niche, and now they're kind of dominating the market as far as new models coming out. And obviously, there's a lot of people who like to see themselves as adventurers and willing to go to far-flung places, go off-road, and the adventure bikes just will do anything you want for a motorcycle.
Well, and you know, the thing about the adventure bikes, and I think we talked about this in the last episode, is they're kind of the two-wheeled SUV, you know, in the sense of they can kind of do a little bit of everything, you know, and these days, adventure bikes, you really don't have to give up performance relative to, say, a sport bike or a traditional sport tour. You don't have to give up the technology. And in fact, some of these adventure bikes are really where they're coming out with some of the latest technology. I mean, the KTM 1190 Adventure in 2014, first motorcycle with cornering ABS. The Ducati Multistrada V4 that came out a couple of years ago was one of the first bikes that had front and rear radar for blind spot detection and so forth. So, you know, it's because they're selling so well. And, you know, if we go back to the 2008, Great Recession, you know, that's really where the motorcycle sales really plummeted from over a million to, you know, about half of that. And, you know, they've really kind of stayed a little stagnant ever since. But the bright spot in motorcycle sales as a segment over the past decade or so has been adventure bikes. And that kind of includes dual sports. You know, it's really the kind of 650 and up, you know, but all dual sports and adventure bikes are really the bikes that have sold the best.
When they were first coming out, they were always the big bikes, right? R1100s, R1200s, KTM 1190 Adventures. And now what I really appreciate as a smaller person, a smaller rider, is the middleweight category. Well, they call it middleweight, but they're pushing 1,000 cc. But they're much easier to handle than the bigger bikes. And with the advances in engine technology, I think these bikes have more than enough power to, you know, do anything you want, go cross country or whatever, and just have it packaged in a tidier platform that still has enough performance, and yet it's a little bit easier to manage.
Sure, absolutely. You know, I didn't start riding motorcycles off-road. I know a lot of people kind of grew up riding dirt bikes. That's one way people kind of come into the sport. You know, I was an adult and started riding street bikes. So I'm always much more comfortable on pavement with the additional traction. And it sort of just feels, you know, like kind of my natural sort of, you know, surface to be on. But I've enjoyed doing a lot of off-road riding. And I owned a KLR 650. I know you did some dirt bike riding, you did some motocross and stuff like that. I've never really done strict dirt bike stuff on, you know, non-plated bikes and motocross tracks. But I've ridden the big adventure bikes like you have, the 1200 GSs, and now it's a 1300 GS, and there's the 1290 Super Adventures. And those bikes, particularly the GS with its boxer engine with the weight down low, handle really well and perform really well off-road, but they're still bikes that can be well over 500 pounds, 600 pounds. I mean, like a Triumph Tiger Explorer Rally, I think weighs close to 650 pounds. I mean, that's a huge bike to have to manage in, let's say, a sand wash, you know?
Yeah, just the manageability combined with the more than adequate power of the mid-weights, I think that's a sweet spot. The Yamaha Tenere T7, I think that really sparked a lot of people's imagination of what a middleweight adventure bike could do. And it seems like that bike has just got all kinds of devotees to it. You know, it's really hit that sweet spot. And now there's a whole bunch of other options. I just got back from Spain to ride the F900 GS BMW, which the F800 GS, which that bike came from, that came out, I think, in 2007. And it was a nice enough bike, but it wasn't really inspirational as far as adventures go. And now this new one, it's got 900 cc, 105 horsepower, and it's a fantastic bike. I really enjoyed riding that.
So, you know, when you were riding that, did you ride both on-road and off-road at that launch?
Yeah, we did morning on road, and 21-inch front wheels are maybe not your first choice for curving canyon corners, but it did just fine there. And then when we got to take it off road, did, you know, a little bit technical stuff, and I felt totally comfortable on the bike. Instead of being along for the ride like I am sometimes on a 1200 cc adventure
Right.
bike, I felt like I was in control. And it reminded me a fair bit of the Tiger 900 that I also rode a couple months ago. And yeah, it was just a real nice sweet spot where it would do anything you wanted to. And when you're on the road, there's not a lot of compromises to be made. So it can be a legitimate sport touring machine too.
Well, you know, and the thing about sort of like it used to be this sort of way with sport tours. It's this way with adventure bikes is people, you know, there's no one bike that will do everything really, really well. Some do a reasonably good job, but you know, heavier bikes are more challenging off-road, but maybe they're more solid. They've got you know, bigger bikes often have bigger engines, they may have more power. So if you're carrying a lot of gear, a lot of luggage, if you're going two up with a passenger, you know, a bigger bike makes a lot more sense. You know, being on you know, a Tenere 700 with a passenger, well, you know, it's you hope you don't have a lot of headwinds and steep hills and things like that. So, you know, it really depends. And then, of course, you know, there are bikes that are adventure styled but are not actually intended to go off road. You know, I mean, they are ones that, for example, you rode the Suzuki GSX-S 1000GX Plus. Which is based on the GSX S1000 GT, which is more of a, you know, traditional sport tour. It's based, you know, on a sport bike. It's got a version of a GSX R1000 engine in it, but the GX is a more upright riding position. It looks more like an adventure bike, but it still has 17-inch wheels and street rubber and things like that.
Yeah, I think manufacturers have noted the popularity of adventure bikes, and one of the assets to them is a more open riding position, a taller seat, so you got more leg room, more upright riding position. And yeah, that GX Plus, that was a really fun bike. You wouldn't want to really take it off road, but that adventure style with the taller suspension, and especially with a semi-active suspension, the Suzuki's is excellent on that bike. It really controls that long travel suspension, and it makes a legitimate sport bike, really. It's just taller. And along that same line, at the F900 GS launch, I also got to ride the M1000 XR BMW, which is a 201 horsepower, also in that crossover category. It's taller than the 1000R, but it had semi-active suspension. So I'm hammering on acceleration, 200 horsepower, and you know, fantastic brakes. And the semi-active suspension is keeping everything all at a level, and so you can ride the thing like a sport bike, and even with the long travel suspension, and it's all kept nicely under control.
Well, and you know, I'm a taller rider, or you know, taller than average. I'm 6 foot. I've got a 34-inch inseam, so I appreciate. And I'm somebody who likes to do lots of miles. You know, if I can just go from, you know, sun up to sundown and just go, and just stop for gas, an adventure bike allows me to do that more comfortably. You know, you know, you've got more leg room, so my legs are not folded up under me. My knees aren't, you know, getting achy. My back can be more straight. I can have my arms out, you know, more. You know, adventure bikes often have wider handlebars or more upright. And so, you know, if your back's not crouched, if your arms aren't in kind of a huddled sort of position like you could be, say, on a sport bike or even some sport tours, you know, you can just ride longer with less fatigue. And or you're just, you know, and I'm 50, so it's like when I get off a bike at the end of the day, it doesn't, you know, I used to be able to get off of anything and didn't really care, but now, yeah, it really matters what I'm riding. And so yeah, I think that's a big attraction of adventure bikes for a lot of people. But the challenge is, we hear this from a lot of readers, is because of their long travel suspension and ground clearance for bikes that are, you know, it have off-road capability, they're naturally going to have a taller seat height. And so seat heights that are 33, 34 inches are really challenging for a lot of riders that are short in seam. Maybe they're older, whatever their situation may be. And this is something I know you've seen with a lot of motorcycle come out. They'll have, if not a dual height seat where you can move it up or down, like maybe, you know, nearly an inch, that at least in the accessory catalog, they typically have a low seat that might drop seat height by another inch. Companies like BMW and Triumph sometimes sell models that are low ride height, so they actually have less suspension travel. So they're designed because, you know, you have to, if you're going to reduce suspension travel, you have to have a shorter kickstand and you have to have a number of other things to make sure you're not dragging hard parts. So you can't just do that easily. But there's also, which came out on the, we talked about this in the last episode in the 2021 Harley-Davidson Pan America, is the adaptive ride height, where they now have this semi-active suspension that can actually knows you're coming to a stop and can lower the suspension and bring seat height. I think it's up to 2 inches, lowers the seat height up to 2 inches, and you don't even really feel it. It just does it, and it just, yeah.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see Harley be the first with that. And at that F900 launch, I also took a quick spin on the new R1300 GS BMW, and that has some kind of adaptive ride height. It brings the seat down, and that bike is pretty amazing because the GSs were always they always felt big and gangly to me, and this new 1300, new from the ground up. It feels like a much smaller bike. And then with the adaptive ride height or whatever BMW calls it, brings the seat down. I had no trouble managing that. It's really a great addition to adventure bikes for the shorter in-seamed riders like me.
Well, you know, mentioning the GS, I mean, any conversation about adventure bikes, obviously the GS is part of the conversation because really the R80 GS that came out in 1980 is kind of the granddaddy of the adventure bike movement. I don't even think they were called adventure bikes back then. They were, you know, the GS stands for Gelandestraße, which means like off-road, on-road. And so there have been dual sport bikes and there have been scramblers and there, you know, in the 60s and 70s, those bikes were very popular. A lot of times they were based on street bikes. And so they maybe had the high pipes or they had some knobbier tires or something like that, but they were still essentially street bikes. You know, the R80 GS, I've not ridden that original model, but I know it's really credited as being one of the first bikes that is basically equally capable on and off road. It's comfortable off on road in terms of it has enough power, it has enough performance that you can do a lot of long distance touring on that bike. But then it was also very capable off-road. I mean, when the after the GS came out, it went and won several Paris-Dakar rallies, you know. So that was certainly a credit to its capability off-road. But that's a bike that had shaft drive, you know. I mean, it's not what you associate with an off-road motorcycle.
Just interestingly, I flipped through an old copy of the first magazine cover I was on. I was riding a BMW R1100 GS. That was the first GS I had ridden. That was 1994,
Wow.
and I remember that, like, coming off of sport bikes and dirt bikes, that thing was massive. It felt like a real struggle for me just to push it around the backyard and get out of the fence or the gate or whatever. But yeah, that bike that was the followed the R80 GS, and boy, BMW's been killing it in terms of the adventure market.
Yeah, I mean, so we're the 2024 R1300 GS, I mean, that's 44 years after the R80 GS came out. And what's interesting is, you know, it's not like there weren't, BMW is definitely credited with coming out with the first adventure bike. But then, as you said, they remained pretty niche and obscure for a long time. You know, I mean, the 80s were kind of the sport bike wars. There were certainly cruisers and there were a lot of the big touring bikes in terms of Goldwings and Cavalcades and Voyagers and things like that. There were lots of huge touring bikes. But you get into the 90s, 90s was certainly the decade of the cruiser. That's when the Harley juggernaut really took off. And there were waiting lists to get Harley Davidsons, and people were reselling them and all kinds of stuff. But it was really after I went back and looked at what we've published in Rider over the years, and this is before my time. I started working at the magazine in 2008, but you can really sort of chart the progression or growth of the adventure bike market by looking at what bikes we were testing. And so, like, I even wrote some down, like, the 90s, there were bikes like in addition to the R, what went to the 80 to the 100s, then it became the R1100GS and then the 1150. And so it has progressed. There was the F650GS has been around since early 90s. That's a parallel twin as opposed to the Boxer twin. Triumph had the Tiger, in the 90s. So that was a, big triple. Probably I've not ridden one of those old Tigers from that era, but it doesn't, I mean, it had spoked wheels and a 19-inch front and some knobbier tires, but probably was a bit of a handful off-road. There was the Kagiva Elephant. I mean, that was another Paris Dakar style bike. So there were bikes out there. I mean, all those are European bikes, but the Suzuki V-Strom, the DL1000 came out in 2002. And that was really kind of that sort of started things off where, a Japanese brand approached it. And I think they called that a sport enduro. I mean, everybody kind of has their own way of classifying these bikes, and 2 years later, they came out with the V-Strom 650, which many people would say was kind of the better balanced bike, even if it didn't make as much power. I mean, the DL1000 had the same 90-degree V-twin that was in the TL1000S and 1000R, so it's basically had a former sport bike engine. The engine that went in the V-Strom 650 was from the SV650, which is a fantastic motorcycle, but absolutely bulletproof bikes. KTM was a dirt bike brand for many years and small Austrian brand. They came out with their big 950 Adventure in 2003. But again, I don't know how many they sold back then, but probably not very many, I mean, it was very capable, but it was big. It had this kind of weird dual fuel tank thing with two fillers. And it was so 2005 is when BMW came out with the R1200GS. So you were talking about the 1150GS. That was this big, enormous motorcycle. They really went on a weight reduction campaign with the 1200, and it became, well, not light and small, but relatively speaking to the 1150. But it's interesting is the 2005 is also when Buell came out with the Ulysses, which they called the world's first adventure sport bike. So,
And now they'd call it a crossover. It had a 17-inch front wheel, and that followed the Ducati Multistrada, which was also a taller adventure style bike, but had 17-inch wheels. It wasn't really meant for off-road. But yeah, that was the era when things started really growing in what an adventure bike could be, and it's really blossomed.
And for me, what I would say is I'm glad you mentioned the Multistrada because there was there's the 1000 and the 1100, and it had kind of this summer sort of a super motard style, big super motard bike, and everybody talked about how fun it was to ride in the canyons. Some of those models were a little bit funky. I mean, that was a Pierre Tourblanche design that had the what was it? The fairing and the windscreen were separate, and like the windscreen turned with the handlebars, but the
Right.
front fairing didn't. So it had the tucked pipes tucked under the rear seat, at least some of the models. So that was also very popular. I mean, that it was on the Ducati 916. I mean, there had some cool design features, but it was a little bit of a funky bike. It was kind of like a love it or hate it,
No one would ever call that the prettiest Ducati ever, but I tell you, when I see them now, the single side swing arm and the air-cooled motor fully on display, I kind of think they're cooler than ever, and yeah, it might be a good used bike for somebody shopping or the adventure curious rider out there.
Absolutely. So, but 2010 is the Multistrada. They completely changed the platform. They went to, what we would consider, what's funny is what is a calling card of many adventure bikes is the beak. It basically the fairing has this protrusion, and the Multistrada back then, 2010, still to this day, but more so back then, it looked kind of like this bird of prey. It was kind of like, this the beak on an eagle or something like that. And that was, basically it was not really a functional fender. They had a low fender that hugged the wheel, but it was based on, you know, rally bikes and adventure and so forth that had big high fenders and stuff like that. But the Multistrada of 2010 still had 17 inch wheels, but it was the bike that came out with what they called the four bikes in one concept, where it had these ride modes and it would adjust power level, throttle response, traction control. It was before cornering ABS, but there was sport, there was touring, urban, and enduro modes. And so basically they're like, hey, you can just push a button and this bike will change its settings and make it more appropriate for each of these four environments.
Yeah, and it was fairly successful at it. And then a little bit after that, they added a model that had 19-inch front wheels, right? The Multistrada had 19s on a certain model. And yeah, it made it more capable in the dirt instead of just a bike that looked like it could do adventure-y things, but it wasn't really that appropriate for it.
Well, and you know, another thing about that Multistrada, the 2010 Multistrada, is it made 150 horsepower. I mean, it had a sport bike engine in it. I mean, so did the V-Strom 1000, but at a very different sort of, you know, tuning and level. So to be able to have a 150 horsepower sport bike in an adventure package is what that was. And that really is what we've, ever since that bike started that, you know, KTM went from its big, you know, 950, the 990 dually, you know, which looked like a big rally bike. They came out with the 1190 Adventure in 2014. And again, 150 horsepower, it went up as the engine size went up to 160 and so forth. Motorcycle traction control, cornering ABS, you know, they just, as they had, if you're like going to have that much power, you just like you do in a lot of sport bikes, you need to have it manageable. You need to basically, you know, can you adjust the power level off? You don't need 150 horsepower off road. So, yeah.
But you might enjoy that on the way to your off road section.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, you and I have both been to a lot of adventure bikes launches, and, you know, as you know, we've been on enough different bikes that you can usually figure them out pretty fast, you know, but what often happens is you and I'll go out, be at a launch, and you'll be on a street ride, and then you basically take a left onto a dirt road or a gravel road, and everybody stops, and everybody's fiddling with buttons and menus, and they're trying to make sure, you know, and some bikes are, make it easier than others. There can just be a mode button, and you can just switch from one to the other, and it changes all the relevant settings. Like if you switch to an off-road mode from a street mode, it'll put it in what is usually considered off-road ABS. It turns it off at the rear wheel so you can lock up the rear wheel as you need to, changes the intervention at the front wheel, changes the traction control settings. But almost always on these bigger bikes, it's going to cut the power from like 150 to maybe 90 horsepower at the rear wheel. Right. So still plenty.
And all these bikes we've been talking about on this lineage up to where we are today, they were all bigger bikes, 1,000cc plus. And then it was around 2010 that some smaller versions came out, right? The F800 GS from BMW was around 2010.
Yeah, 2009. Yeah, that was actually a Riders Motorcycle of the Year in 2009. Because, yeah, it was like highly capable 21-inch front wheel, but it was a more manageable size and it was quite a bit lighter than, well, I think it was only about 50 pounds lighter than our 1200 GS, but 50 pounds makes a big difference when you're riding off road.
Especially if you're picking it up out of the sand.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, you're right. Cause you know, Triumph came out with its 800 Tigers. There was the standard, which was more, and Triumph's always had this kind of approach with its Tiger adventure bikes where it'll have street versions and off-road versions. So it used to be just the Tiger 800 or the XE was the one that had the 21-inch front wheel and spoked wheels and so forth. You just went to the Tiger 900 launch and they've got GT versions, which are for the street. You could ride them off-road, but you know they've got cast wheels and 19-inch front. Or there are the rally versions, right?
Yeah, the rally version comes with the 21-inch front wheel. And as you know, if you're in a low traction situation, the 21-inch wheel and tire bite in much more confidently than a 19. So yeah, the 21-inchers is the way to go when you're serious about going off-road.
Yeah. You know, and the thing is, a lot of these bikes, big adventure bikes, most of them come with, because, you know, they can be ridden off-road, but most of them are still ridden primarily on the pavement because, you know, not that many people live right next door to a backcountry discovery route. So they've got to ride quite a few miles to get to any sort of trail or forest road or something. So most bikes come with what are called 90-10 tires, which is considered like 90% of its usage will be on-road and 10% will be off-road. So It has pretty big tread blocks, but it kind of looks like more like a sport touring tire. You know, it might look a little blockier. They work okay, but not great. Like I said, you know, on a gravel road or something, they're probably, you know, fine or hard packed dirt. You get into some sands, you know, obviously you get anything like mud or anything, they're not very useful. And then you can kind of work your way down and get to something that looks almost like a full sport bike, I mean, full dirt bike knobby. And, you know, people have to make the compromise like, all right, well, the knobbier the tire and more aggressive the knobbies, they don't necessarily grip as well on the street. They don't feel as planted as, you know, when you've got a big contact patch. So again, there's the trade-off with the bikes, but then there's the trade-off with the tires and stuff that people choose to use. So.
Yeah, so many things in motorcycling is a compromise. It's like the seat heights. Everybody wants a lot of suspension travel, but a lot of people don't want to swing their legs 35 inches in the air to get a board one. And it's the same thing with tires. Knobby tires, I'm sure you've had this experience. You put knobby tires on and you're happy as a clam in the dirt, and then you get on the road and 1,000 miles later you have no tire left. So it's always a compromise.
They wear out a lot faster, and so I mean, I was kind of charting the all of the bikes that were released, and you actually nailed it on the head. I mean, because after 2010, there were, you know, a lot of companies basically started to like wanted to have bikes that would fit in multiple segments. So like, you know, in the early 2000s, Suzuki had the 1000 V-Strom and then the 650 V-Strom. So we've got the middleweight and the leader class. You know, there was the R1200 GS, and then there was the 900, or excuse me, the 800 back then came out. So smaller bikes. And then it's interesting, I was looking at the three bikes that were released in the same year in 2018 was the BMW G310 GS. So it's a 310 roughly cc single small bike. The Kawasaki Versus X300 came out that same year. So again, I think that had an engine that was in I guess a Ninja 300 probably is what that came from. And again, much more manageable size and weight. And then Royal Enfield came out with its Himalayan, or they call it Himalayan, which is what at the time was much more of a low tech, air cooled, wasn't even a unit construction engine, but built pretty bulletproof because it was, you know, designed and built to be ridden in India, which the roads are hellacious there, and the conditions are pretty bad. So those are three bikes that were in the 300 CC class. Well, I guess the Himalayan was a 410, but still, it only made 24 horsepower. So these were much more affordably priced, lower seat heights, lower weights, but you know, more limited capability, more limited technology, and so forth. So they're really, you know, for a different type of rider. But it was, you know, we had the little bike class, the Tiddlers.
I'll throw out a bone too for the KTM 390 Adventure, which is a fairly manageable yet fairly powerful bike. But yeah, you mentioned the V-Stroms. That's one thing that a lot of lay persons in motorcycling don't understand. I want a new engine for my perfect adventure bike, and it doesn't make sense to develop a one engine for just one bike. So the V-Stroms had the SV650 and the V-Strom 650, for example. And pretty much every engine that's produced now is used in multiple models. The F900 GS, you can also get that engine in the F900R. And it makes sense to use the same, all the engineering. That's the most expensive part to develop on a motorcycle is the engine. And so if you can use it in a couple different models, then it makes much more financial sense for the manufacturer to do so.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, there is Triumph, BMW, KTM, Kawasaki, Suzuki, all of these companies, you know, try to figure out ways to, you know, they can put an engine in an adventure bike and a naked bike and different ones. BMW's got a little bit of a weird practice where, for example, when they came out with the F800 GS in 2009, soon after that, they came out with the F750 GS. So it had the same 798 cc displacement, but the F750 GS was tuned to make less power and the bike was more street oriented. So it was still a GS, but instead of the 21 inch front wheel and spoked wheels and so forth, it had cast wheels and a 19 inch front. And they've always had this sort of thing where they have, and again, most recently there's the F900 GS, but there's also the What do they call the street version?
F800GS.
They call it the
The
F800GS, which is
960 motor in it, but they call it an F800. It's a pet peeve of mine how they play with numbers like that. Just say what the number is according to the engine, and you can use a different model name instead of making up a different number that doesn't apply, right?
I mean, BMW's got their thing where the F designation is for their parallel twin, the G is for their single. I mean, remember when they used to make the G450X motocross bike, or was it, or it wasn't motocross bike, but it was a dual sport bike.
Cool
It was
sport,
a
yeah.
dual sport, yeah. The R is their boxer engine. The K is the inline engine. So there's the K1600, which is, you know, six cylinder, but they used to have, you know, four cylinder versions of it, so forth. So yeah, they've just got to stick with their F version, but they don't want, and they want to be in multiples of 50. They don't want to do like a F775 GS or something like that. So yeah, it's a, well, I mean, KTM's got their thing. They have the KTM 790 Adventure, and they have the 890 Adventure, and they have the 790 Duke, and they have the 990 Duke, and they have, so they all have the 90s, even though that's not exactly what their displacement is. It's
Right.
just,
At
it's
least
their,
it's closer than the F800, which is a 897 cc or whatever it is, 895.
well, you know, for you and I both, I think, you know, with the adventure bikes, I'm one of those people, I don't care what brand it is, and I don't even care what style it is. I just like to ride motorcycles. I mean, I do have a I don't want to say a preference, but, you know, in terms of fit and performance, modern adventure bikes are, do a lot of things for me. Whereas like a lot of cruisers, I can enjoy riding them, but maybe they have limited cornering clearance, or they don't rev out that far. They've got great low end torque, but they don't have a lot of power or something like that. And maybe that's not why most people buy cruisers, you know. There have been a lot of power cruisers over the years that never sold very well.
Exactly.
But you know, it's our magazine is it ends up being chock full of these adventure bikes, and I'm sure we have some readers that are cruiser guys that are just like, "Hey man, I'm tired of reading about adventure bikes." I'm like, "Well, tell the manufacturers, because when's, I mean, other than a brand like Harley-Davidson or Indian, where their bread and butter is their cruisers and baggers, but the Japanese cruiser, you know, they there used to be tons of Japanese cruisers. There was the There still is the Boulevard line within Suzuki, but Yamaha had a separate star line, and now they're just under the Yamaha name, but they don't make many models, and Honda doesn't make many cruisers. They still make the Fury for some reason. I mean, that thing came to the chopper party late, and it's sticking around well past its welcome.
I guess they must be selling a few of them to
They
keep them kind
must.
of alive.
Yeah, they must. So yeah, I mean, it's just the market is going to go after what is selling, you know. I mean, it used to be, I mean, you were in the industry during the sport bike wars, but I mean, it used to be with, especially in the 900 class and the 1000 or the 600 class, 1000 class, there used to be a 750 class, but especially six, they would come out with new versions of those sport bikes every 2 years.
Yeah, heavily updated after 2 years and completely re-overhauled after four. It was
Yeah.
incredible.
You know, and they were competing on the racetrack, you know, because whether it was AMA or Superbike, you know, or whatever it was, is that, you know, Honda, Yamaha, Suzuki, Kawasaki, those four Japanese brands in particular, but some of the others, you know, that and European brands, they were neck and neck. And, you know, it was that win on Sunday, sell on Monday mentality. But there's not much factory support in Moto America anymore. Yeah, I don't know if that there's any from the Japanese brands.
The biggest factory support in Moto America is now from Harley-Davidson and Indian. They got the biggest setups in the Moto America paddock. It's incredible to see how things have shifted around.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I know there's a hooligan class for racing. Isn't there going to be a new class that's going to allow the Pan America?
The Super Hooligan class allows the Pan America, but with an intake restrictor, so it
Okay.
gets choked down a bit to match up better with Indian's FTR 1200. So
Gotcha.
that's going on. And then at Sturgis this summer, they're having a flat track race in downtown Sturgis, and there's going to be an adventure bike class. I'm not sure of the rules yet, but that should be entertaining at the very least.
Wow. So you know, I live in Ventura, and we are one of the few places in Southern California where there's still a dirt track. I mean, it's right on the water. Our Ventura County Fairgrounds are, it's basically prime, you know, beachfront property. It's not used that much, but there's, you know, as part of the fairgrounds is this, I think it's a quarter mile dirt track. And so they, you know, between March and November, it's on most weekends, it's sprint cars and dwarfs and stuff like that. But they, four or five times a year on a Saturday, they'll do flat track racing. It's typically club level. It's vintage bikes and people with, you know, CRF 100s or something with flat track tires on them, something. Now, last year they did the AMA, or the AFT short track at Ventura, and you and I were up at the Quail. But this year it's they're doing it again in May. They're going to do the AMA flat track, or the excuse me, AFT flat track short track. But whenever they do these kind of like, you know, more local club races, I remember they used to do bagger racing there. They would have guys instead of the bagger racing where you're on a road racing circuit like King of the Baggers, they would have some guy with his actual Road King or Street Glide or whatever with street tires out on this dirt track, and they would just be hanging it out there. And it was pretty nuts. It was cool to see. Every now and then somebody crash and fiberglass saddlebag would just grenade or something like that. But I was like, man, the guts those guys have to do that.
Down here in Costa Mesa Speedway or Costa Mesa Fairgrounds, they also have Harley Night, where
Really?
in addition to the speedway racers, they have guys bring out their Harleys and like baggers and choppers and all kinds of things. And it's one of the most well-attended nights of the season because you never know what's going to happen, right? It's going to be some kind of I don't know if I want to say shit show, but there's going to be some going on.
Well, you know, it's interesting to just the idea of adventure bike racing. I mean, I know there are things, there are rallies and people you can do rally racing and things like that. But the idea of an adventure bike race at Sturgis, I can't wait to see some of the photos and footage, you know. So what's interesting is in terms of, you know, thinking about bikes that are coming up that I haven't ridden yet that I hope to ride soon. There's the new Stelvio, Moto Guzzi Stelvio. We actually published a test that Alan Cathcart did. He's got insider access to a lot of stuff. But, you know, the Stelvio came out 20 years ago and it was always kind of an ugly duckling. You know, I mean, Moto Guzzis are, they've got their own sort of character and style and so forth. But the Stelvio was always a little bit of a funky bike. Now, a fully modern looking bike. And it's got the engine that's adapted from the V100 Mandello, which is the most modern Moto Guzzi engine they've ever produced. It's got a lot of cool features. You can also, we haven't tested one yet, but you can also get it with some of these radar features that are, you know, blind spot detection and adaptive cruise control, which I've used on multiple motorcycles and is actually very cool. In late March, I am going to the Philippines to ride the CF Moto IBEX 450. Which I was at the AMEXPO show in Vegas in February, and they unveiled that. It's going to be a 2025 model that is going to come out in September. But CF Moto, they're a Chinese manufacturer. They've got a partnership with KTM. They produce the 790 engine for the 790 Adventure and the 790 Duke. A version of that engine is used in CF Moto's IBEX 800 adventure bike, which we've tested. But the 450, they've got a 450 parallel twin. And you were talking about this earlier. It's basically like, how can you take a good engine and put it in as many different motorcycles as possible? So they've got the CF Moto 450 SS sport bike, which Allison Parker, our associate editor, tested for us. I've got the 450 NK naked bike. It's really fun to ride. AMEXPO, they announced the 450 CLC. So that's a cruiser that runs the same 450 parallel twin. Then the IBEX 450, which is a very cool looking rally style adventure bike, 21 inch front wheel. It's $6,500 and it has tubeless spoked wheels, which is really like a very premium feature that I don't think there's any many bikes at all or would be less than maybe 12 grand that you can get tubeless spoke wheels on.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, because like, you know, you mentioned the Yamaha Tenere 700 tube type spoked wheels. That's an $11,000 motorcycle. The Honda Transalp, which came out this year, which is, you know, a great bike, it's getting a lot of attention. Sort of the return of the Icon, also tube type spoked wheels. And man, I don't ever want to have to fix a tube type flat, you know, on the trail, even in my garage with the tools, I don't want to have to do it. So the idea that you can just plug a tubeless tire and you can be back on the road in 20 minutes. Anyway, I think that's very cool. So we'll get a chance to ride that in the Philippines. And the 450 class, there's really not anything in that. And I mean, we talked about the 300s, you know, the BMW 310 GS, the Kawasaki Versus X300 or 300X KTM 390 Adventure. But 450 is a little bit bigger, so it's got a little bit more power. But there's not really anybody in that space at the moment in terms of adventure bikes. And I don't know what their claimed weight on it is, but to me, that would be like the perfect size motorcycle. Might be a little bit limited on the road, depending on the amount of gear that you're carrying, but 450 would be enough power to be able to have fun off-road, but not, you know, again, light is right off when it comes to be off-road. So
totally agree. And I'm really excited about the Royal Enfield Himalayan that, was it Tim Kessel?
Yeah, Tim Kessel. Yeah, he went to the India to test that last October.
That sounds like a really great option for somebody who's, you know, not going to be, you know, wanting to go cross country on a motorcycle, but wants right. to explore back roads, off road. It seems like a really nice size. And the former Himalayan, that was kind of, let's see, what's a nice way to say gutless? It wasn't
powered.
It wasn't a great motor, but this new one is a modern motor, and I think it's got 40 horsepower, which
it's not a
powerhouse, but it's going to do the job.
And you know, Royal Enfields are not known for being the lightest motorcycles because they're built like a tank, you know. Yeah. But that's a good thing in terms of durability. But yeah, the engine's now a unit construction of liquid cooled 450 instead of a 410, makes 40 horsepower. It's got throttle by wire. It's got a slip assist clutch. You know, the 2023, the older version or the previous version of the Himalayan was $5,500. So I can't imagine the new version will be a lot more expensive than that. Let's call it $6,000. And you're still looking at a very affordable motorcycle. And if your ambitions are not to just, you know, huck it off the dunes, like you see in a lot of brochures for adventure bikes, I think, yeah, it'd be a really solid option. They haven't, I didn't get a chance to go to that launch. Had to send Tim to Northern India for that one. But they will be releasing it in the US this summer. So hopefully they'll have a launch. We'll be able to get our hands on a bike and we'll be able to test it, you know, kind of on home turf. I like you, I want to get a chance to ride it, you know.
And let's throw a 390 Adventure KTM in with that and see which single cylinder adventure bike is the best.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Duke, I appreciate you chatting about adventure bikes with me. I think we've covered a lot of terrain. You know, there's still a lot of bikes that, you know, we've tested. We have reviews of any bikes that we've gone to launches or gotten test bikes. They're on ridermagazine.com. We have them in the magazine, but there are more to come. I mean, there are some of these bikes that have been announced, like you said, you know, that we haven't had an opportunity to ride, and we'll get tests of those as soon as we can. So anything else before we wrap up?
No, I just think it's an exciting time in motorcycling because, you know, you talk about sport bikes, right? If you're not riding a sport bike in a sporty manner, it's not really a great motorcycle. An adventure bike can do anything. So it just opens up the options. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. Well, for the Rider Magazine Insider Podcast, I'm Greg Jevonstead. Thanks for listening. Keep the rubber side down.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Rider Magazine Insider Podcast, please subscribe. Leave us a positive rating and tell your friends. We also encourage you to visit ridermagazine.com, where you can get the latest in motorcycle news and reviews and sign up for our free weekly newsletter. You can also subscribe to print and digital editions of Rider Magazine, which is published 12 times a year. Thanks again for listening.